From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. When the Vietnam War ended and Saigon fell in April 1975, Americans got their enduring impression of the event from television.
Good evening. A quarter century of American involvement in South Vietnam is over. At mid-afternoon, Saigon time, an armada of 81 U.S. Marine helicopters descended on the South Vietnamese capital. More than 6,000 persons, as many as 900 of them Americans, the rest Vietnamese and third country nationals, were evacuated, plucked from the U.S. embassy grounds, from rooftops throughout the city, and from the nearby Tonsonut Airport.
But there was another evacuation that didn't get news coverage. U.S. Navy ships saved another 20 to 30,000 Vietnamese refugees.
The full scope of this humanitarian rescue has been largely untold, lost in time and in bitterness over the Vietnam War. But correspondent Joseph Shapiro and producer Sandra Bartlett from NPR's investigative unit interviewed more than 20 American and Vietnamese eyewitnesses. And they studied hundreds of documents, photographs, and other records, including many never made public before. Here's Joseph Shapiro with part one of our report and the story of one small U.S. Navy ship.
On the morning of April 29, 1975, the USS Kirk and its crew stood off the coast of South Vietnam in the South China Sea.
As I'm sure you know by this time, Vietnam has surrendered, and the mass panic, almost panic-stricken retreat has already taken place.
Sitting on his bunk, the ship's chief engineer, Hugh Doyle, records a cassette tape to send home to his wife, Judy.
I really don't know where to start. It's been such an unusual couple days. Where we fit in was really interesting. You're probably not going to believe half the things I tell you, but believe me, they are all true.
Doyle's cassette tapes, which until now have never been heard publicly, provide one of the best accounts of one of the most extraordinary humanitarian missions in the history of the U.S. Navy. The Kirk's military mission that day was to shoot down any North Vietnamese jets that might try to stop U.S. Marine helicopters as they evacuated people from Saigon. The North Vietnamese planes never came, but the Kirk's mission was about to change, and suddenly. Doyle told Judy what he and his crewmates saw when they looked towards South Vietnam, some 12 miles away.
We looked up at the horizon, though, and pretty soon all you could see were helicopters. And they came and just, it was incredible. I don't think I'll ever see anything like it again.
It looked like bees flying all over the place, trying to find some place to land.
Paul Jacobs was captain of the Kirk.
Every one of those Hueys probably had 15 to 20 people on board. But they're all headed east, trying to escape.
Kent Chipman, a 21-year-old Texan, worked in the engine room.
What was freaky, and it gives me goosebumps to today. It'd be real quiet and calm and not a sound. And then all of a sudden, you could hear the helicopter coming. You'd hear the big choop, 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 choop of the Hueys.
These were South Vietnamese Huey helicopters. Military pilots had crammed their aircraft with family and friends and flown out to the South China Sea. They were pretty sure that the U.S. Navy's 7th Fleet was in that ocean somewhere. Now they were desperately looking for some place to land. Here's Hugh Doyle speaking today.
Well, they were flying out to sea. Some of them were very low on fuel, and some of them were crashing alongside the larger ships. They were crashing in the water, and I don't know how many Vietnamese refugees were lost in all that.
But the helicopters flew past the Kirk. They were looking for a large carrier deck to land. Jim Bongard, a radar man, was watching all the traffic dotting the radar scope when Captain Jacobs issued orders.
The skipper got real excited. He called down to us and said, you need to try to advertise and see if you can get these guys on the radio, just announcing our hull number, and we have an open flight deck. If you want to come land on us, we can take you aboard, and that kind of thing, just trying to encourage them to come in.
There was one problem. It wasn't clear that the pilots could land on a moving ship. Don Cox was an anti-submarine equipment officer.
Most of the Vietnamese pilots had never landed on board a ship before. Almost to a man, they were Army pilots, and they typically landed either at fire zones, little clearings in the brush, or at an airport. And the ship looks very, very small, and the deck was very crowded.
Cox was one of the sailors who, not sure if those pilots would land or crash, stood on the flight deck to direct the helicopters in. The first two helicopters landed safely, but then there was no more room. The Kirk was a destroyer escort. It was built to hunt submarines, not land helicopters. It had a landing deck about the size of a tennis court.
I believe it was the third aircraft landed and chopped the tail off the second aircraft that had landed. There was still helicopters circling, wanting to land. There was no room on our deck, so we just started pushing helicopters overboard. We figured humans were much more important than the hardware.
So we couldn't think of what else to do, and these other planes were looking for a place to land, and, you know, we would have lost people in the plane, so we threw the airplane over the side. Yeah, really.
As one helicopter landed and the people scrambled off, dozens of sailors ran over to push the aircraft over the side and into the ocean. But Kent Chipman says it wasn't easy. The Vietnamese helicopters were heavy, and because they were designed to land in fields, they had skids instead of wheels.
The flight deck has non-skid on it. I mean, it's like real rough sandpaper. And the Hueys didn't have tires on them. They had like skids, and we'd have to just work it this way and work it that way till we got it over to the edge, and then there'd be like 30 people just fighting their way to get over there and try to help, you know?
With one final shove, the helicopter would totter over the edge of the ship with its tail high in the air, and then crash to the water below.
There were stories, horrible stories, that I've heard from the refugees.
One Vietnamese pilot landed with bullet holes in his aircraft. Hugh Doyle saw he was in shock.
As he was loading his helicopter, had his family killed. They were standing there waiting to get on the helicopter. His family was machine gunned. He was sitting in the helicopter. He was the pilot. He stood there and looked at them. They were all laying dead.
The crew of the Kirk fed the refugees and spread out tarps to protect them from the blazing sun.
We took the people up onto the O2 level, just behind our stack, and we laid mats and all kinds of blankets and stuff out on the deck for their babies. And there were all kinds of, there were infants and children and women, and the women were crying, and it was a scene I'll never forget.
Kent Chipman.
These people are coming out of there with nothing. Whatever they had in their pockets or hands. Some of them had suitcases. Some of them had a bag. You know, you could tell they'd been in a war. They were still wounded. There were people, young, old, army guys with bandages on their head, arms. You could tell they'd been in a fight.
Some of the pilots and their families came from Vietnam's elite, and some of them carried what was left of their wealth in wafers of gold, sometimes sewn into their clothes. The captain locked the gold in his safe. Then there was the helicopter that was too big to land.
This is when the big Chinook came out, and you could tell the sound of it was different, more robust, deep.
This huge helicopter called a Chinook. It's a Boeing. You know, remember down from my mother's house, the Bertol place? Those huge helicopters they made down there? Those great big ones.
Doyle had grown up in Pennsylvania near the factory that made those helicopters.
They came out and tried to land on the ship. Oh, the thing almost crashed on board our ship. So we finally got him to realize to wave him off. He was too big. You know, he just could not have landed. Well, he flew around us a couple times, and he was running low on fuel. Picture this. We're steaming along at about 5 knots, and this huge airplane comes in and hovers over the fantail, opened up its rear door, and started dropping people out of it. It's about 15 feet off the fantail. There's American sailors back on the fantail catching babies like basketballs.
The helicopter wasn't stationary. It'd come in and hover and, you know, trying to get close as they could. I remember at least twice that he went back up, not real high, you know, 60 feet or so, and he'd slowly come back down. The helicopter was probably 8 to 10 foot in the air is off the deck as we were catching the people jumping out. They would kind of scooch out to the door and just kind of drop down, you know, as easily as they could. The noise is tremendous. It's the biggest Chinook they make with the four sets of wheels. The wind off this thing, it's like being in a hurricane.
One mother dropped her baby and her two young children toward the outstretched arms of the sailors below.
I remember the baby coming out. You know, there was no way we're going to let them hit the deck or drop them. We caught them. I was pretty small myself back then, weighed 130 pounds. Even as small as I am, you know, they come flying out and we caught them.
These were the Vietnamese Army pilot's children. He'd saved the lives of his passengers, but now he was out of fuel and surrounded by flat blue ocean. Hugh Doyle saw him fly the huge helicopter about 60 yards from the Kirk. Doyle uses slang and calls it an airplane.
He took the airplane, hovered it very close to the water, took all his clothes off, with the exception of his skivvies, all by himself, no co-pilot, took all his clothes off, threw it out the window, and then he got up on the edge of the window, still holding on to the two sticks that the helicopter has to fly with. He tilted over on its side, still flying in the air, and dove into the water. The airplane just fell right into the water, hit the water on its right-hand side. The rotors just exploded.
There were small pieces, but there are also pieces probably 10, 15 foot long, big pieces, go flying out. It sounded like a giant train wreck, you know, in slow motion. And it's loud, it's, you know, winds blowing everywhere. The Chinook ended upside down. He dove out the side of it. The thing flipped upside down, and then it was calm and quiet again, like you turned off a light switch. I'm thinking, man, this guy just died. I said, this is crazy. And his little head popped out of the water. I said, he's alive. It was pretty cool.
The pilot's name was Bon Nguyen. He and his family were among some 200 refugees rescued from 16 helicopters. On the second day, those refugees, more than half were women, children, and babies, would be moved to a larger transport ship. But the heroics of the Kirk would continue. Shortly before midnight, at the end of the second day, the Kirk's captain, Paul Jacobs, got a call.
And that's when I get it on the shoulder from the XO. He says, hey, 7th Fleet wants to speak to you now. It's urgent.
It was the admiral in charge of the entire rescue.
He says, we're going to have to send you back to rescue the Vietnamese Navy. We forgot them. And if you don't get them or any part of them, they're all probably going to be killed.
The Kirk was being sent back to Vietnam. The South Vietnamese government had fallen. The communists were in control now. The Kirk would be headed into hostile territory by itself.
So I said, am I going to get any support? No. Am I going to get any air cover? No. You're on your own. I said, what's the rules of engagement? He said, there are none.
The Kirk set out to save the South Vietnamese Navy, and it ended up rescuing tens of thousands of desperate Vietnamese refugees. We'll tell you that story tomorrow on All Things Considered. Joseph Shapiro, NPR News.
And you can experience the Kirk's dramatic story in photographs at our website, npr.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
In the next few minutes, we're going to enter the world of roller derby.
All right, Los Angeles, I've got one question for you. Are you ready for roller derby action?
We are, and our guide is a voice you've heard on NPR, reporter Alex Cohen. Public radio reporter by day, that is, by night. For several years, Alex Cohen was known exclusively by her derby name, Axles of Evil. On a recent morning, Alex welcomed us to a giant warehouse on the edge of downtown Los Angeles that was once an ice cream cone factory.
This is what is affectionately known as the Doll Factory, and there is actually, if you can see, a neon roller skate that when turned on is hot pink. So it's home to the Los Angeles Derby Dolls, which is LA's Bank Track Female Roller Derby League.
Bank Track. That refers to the sloped track where skaters can get going really fast, which is, of course, at the heart of roller derby. Axles of Evil has written with another one-time derby doll, Jennifer Casey Bomber Barbie, what they call an insider's guide, down and derby. It's a sport that Alex Cohen never expected to be part of.
I'm 5'2 on a good day. I have never been athletically inclined. I was always kind of the theater and speech and debate geek. And when I started doing derby, I was really amazed to see that I actually really like beating people up.
If you know one thing about roller derby, you know it's rough. And Trixie Biscuit, one of the derby dolls at a recent practice, is proud to be one of the roughest.
I'm a bigger skater than a lot that you'd see. I've always been a bruiser. You know, I was the catcher on the softball team that, you know, go ahead, slide into me. Try it. See where it gets you.
Trixie Biscuit's real name is Katie Wegman. She's a mom who came to Derby in her 30s after serving as a sergeant in the Army Reserve. The way she sees it, Derby is her destiny.
Oh! Gnarly block from Trisky Biscuit against Crava Cadaver, who's jamming for the Arizona Derby Dames.
If anyone can be credited with inventing roller derby, it's a man named Leo Seltzer. Roller skating competitions had been around since the 1880s for men. But decades later, Leo Seltzer put women on skates and in short skirts and sent them on the road in his 1935 transcontinental roller derby. Alex Cohen says the derby guys and gals piled into team buses with trainers, announcers, and trunks full of skating outfits.
It was kind of like a traveling circus. A lot of it was born out of the Depression. So you had young kids who basically gave up their lives, traveled the country, became families with each other. I mean, these were the same skaters that were building the track that they would skate on that evening. I mean, it was just this grueling, grueling endeavor. They got paid no money, but it was their chance at this tiny little sliver of fame.
Over the years, among the biggest crowd pleasers have been rivalries between opposite types, the sweetheart and the mean girl. Jennifer Casey Bomber Barbie says it all started with two gals back in the 1930s.
There was this woman named Jerry Murray, and Jerry Murray was kind of the Betty Grable pinup of roller derby. She was this beautiful woman and very fashionable with her scarf that she would wear. And then there was another one named Midge Tuffy Brassoon, and she was this 4'11" spitfire plumber's daughter. And both of these women, you have to understand, at the time they were 15 and 16 years old when they joined roller derby in the 30s and through the 40s when they were skating, and they had these rivalries that were amazing, and the crowd loved to cheer for Jerry, loved to boo for Tuffy.
Both girls trying to get in. Here they come up the back end of the pack. Tuffy knocked down. That was a fast one. Tuffy Brassoon knocked down, and she is boiling. Well, this partisan chief crowd is giving Tuffy a little of their opinion as she argues with her coach, Buddy Atkinson.
At one game, the fans were so incensed at a move that Tuffy had made that a woman runs up to the track and threw her baby at her. I mean, that blows my mind. Luckily, Tuffy's also very lightning quick reflexes. She was an athlete after all, and she caught the baby, thank goodness. For me, that's roller derby in a nutshell right there. I want those kinds of fans. I don't want babies thrown at me, but I like that kind of passion.
The key to the fascination with women's roller derby is its mix of bold sexuality, females at their fiercest, and also a certain playfulness. Those qualities come out in the derby names. Georgia O'Grief, Tequila Mockingbird, Iron Maven, Judy Gloom. The one who gets to have fun with all those names is the derby announcer. The best score points with their witty commentary. Comedian Jimmy Fallon played an announcer in the recent Drew Barrymore movie about roller derby called Whip It.
Well, our favorite Whole Foods checkout girl is about to bag her some honey. Clean up on aisle five. With time left for only one more jam and the game out of reach, Smashley Simpson is out of here.
Women competing on skates first appeared in the movies back in 1946 in a short film called Roller Derby Girl. In 1972, Raquel Welch strapped on skates in Kansas City Bomber. By then, derby was fading. But in the last decade, derby has made a comeback. Now there are more than 17,000 skaters in more than 400 leagues. Fans pack into the Doll Factory here in L.A. to see Sheila Hot Wheels Noonan and other skaters go at it.
Out here at the L.A. Derby Dolls, you'll get your old school classic cars fan. You'll get your punk rockers, you know, hipsters from the neighborhood. You get this really crazy cross-section because it's this word of mouth, like, I saw this thing, it was really neat, and there was all this other stuff going on, you should check it out. And people show up because of that reputation or because of that allure or the mystique. And then when they watch the game, it's not, you know, an alligator pit. It's actually a very difficult and highly choreographed game. You have to work very hard for every single minute of that hour-long game, and I think that's what brings people back.
Are you ready for roller derby action? Come on, Los Angeles!
If you think derby might be your destiny, you can take the Am I a Derby Girl quiz at npr.org.
I'm talking about roller. roller derby.
The Insider's Guide to Roller Derby, Down and Derby, is by Jennifer Casey Balmer Barbie and Alex Cohen, a.k.a. Axels of Evil. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Go, go, roller girl! Look at that girl roll! Roller derby, save my soul.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. When Deborah Fallows went to live in China with her husband, the journalist James Fallows, she was armed with a few semesters of Mandarin study. Then she got to Shanghai and found she couldn't recognize or speak a single word of what she'd been studying. She writes about her journey through the Chinese language and her many missteps along the way in her new book, Dreaming in Chinese. Deborah Fallows has a PhD in linguistics and speaks half a dozen languages, but Chinese was another story.
I didn't feel like I had anything to hang my hat on with this language. It just bore no resemblance to Romance languages, Germanic languages, Japanese, anything that I'd ever approached before. And there are some things about Chinese that are easy, and then there are a lot of things about Chinese that are hard.
Well, let's talk about that. You point out that Chinese has only 400 syllables, unique syllables, one-tenth of the number that there are in English, which means that there are many, many, many words that sound exactly alike. And that can get you into a lot of trouble, right?
Its homonyms run rampant. Yeah, like in English, if you have, say, the word seal the animal, you have seal a letter. But in Chinese, you have just a plethora of things like that. The issue with Chinese is that they have these very few syllables. You don't, words like ma, ta, he, shi, you don't get a lot of long, complicated syllables like stretch or plump, where you get consonants clustered together to give you all kinds of variety. So there's very little to work with. And that actually connects directly to the tone system of Chinese. Since you have so few syllables to work with, one of the ways out of that in distinguishing one syllable for another to make one word or another is to slap a tone onto it. So you can say sure, 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 sure.
And
you
get meaning four, will change.
And the meaning will change with each of those.
You print a short little story in your book, written in Chinese, called The Lion-Eating Poet in the Stone Den.
That's right.
Which looks like a whole bunch of different Chinese characters on the page, but if you were to read it, what would it sound like?
It would sound all like sure.
Every word.
Every word is sure. The tones might change, but the amazing thing about this poem is that you can tell this entire story using one syllable. It's a real challenge to listen to, especially if your ear is not accustomed to listening and using tones.
And the shu in this poem you're saying means lions, market, ten, eat, and stone, among other words.
Right, among other things. It's a little fable, and it's not a great story, and it doesn't tell a wonderful myth. But it is kind of interesting that you can tell a whole story using one syllable.
You write about something that happened to you one day when you had a craving, an inexplicable craving for cheese when you were living in Shanghai, and you went to Taco Bell, and you were trying to order takeout. And just ran into a buzzsaw of lack of understanding. What happened?
Right. I went in the door and was greeted by this young Chinese guy in a sombrero and little velvet vest and had practiced very hard what I was going to ask him. I wanted to do takeout. The word in Chinese for takeout is da bao. So I wasn't very good at tones at that point. And trying to ask him, do you have da bao? A complete blank look on his face. So I thought, okay, I'm obviously using the tones wrong here. So I'll try da bao with other kinds of tones. So I was trying rising tones, falling and rising tones, any combination of tones I could get for the word da bao. Then I got the menu. I started mimicking, pointing on the menu, pointing to the door as though I were taking a bag out the door, you know, and thinking all this, well, come on, how hard can this be? Finally, he went into the back room, into the kitchen, and came out with three or four other guys. I went through the routine again with da bao, da bao, da bao, anything I could think of. And one of them had this look of eureka on his face, and he said, oh, da bao. And then they all laughed and went into the other room and said, yes, they do. You know, yes, they do. Yo, they do have da bao.
And when you were asking in that Taco Bell for takeout, they might have been thinking, what? What would have sounded similar to what you were asking for?
There are a number of things, some of them more embarrassing than others. I was maybe asking for a hug, and I, of course...
These crazy Westerners. Yeah. You just never know what they'll want. You point up one other thing that well, many other things, but you do point to one glimmer you have into Chinese culture, which has to do with the notion that it can be a very blunt language. To an American, it might seem impolite that there aren't sort of these grace notes, I think you call them, of please and thank you that are added to things.
Right. When people ask you if you want something, like would you like a glass of water, you'd say, bu yao, which just means don't want or don't need, instead of saying, oh, no, thanks, I'm not really thirsty now. Maybe I'll have something later.
Right.
With all this padding and softness that you use to communicate in what you think is a polite way in English, you strip all of that away in Chinese, and it's just bu yao, bu ke yi, don't want, cannot, bu shi, isn't, do not. And I did feel very rude. But then I noticed this funny thing that was going on. For example, if you're in a restaurant watching a group of close friends eating, or maybe it's a family eating, you see this very delicate choreography. For example, you have a common pot of chicken, and maybe the mom in the family's got her chopstick, and she's very delicately picking out the best little chunks of chicken to put on her child's plate. And you see the dad pouring tea or pouring beer for everybody else in the family, as is appropriate, before pouring it for yourself. So you think this is very polite, normal, standard behavior. And then in the midst of all this, one of the kids will say, Gei wo yan, give me the salt. I thought, what's going on? Why this point of difference between what you see as polite and what you hear as being really rude? So I started to look into this a little bit and found that if you're inserting these niceties, these softeners like pleases and thank yous, the Chinese will see that as actually setting up a distance between you and the person you're talking to. So if I say, please pass the salt, you're understanding that I have a certain degree of formality between you and me, which you don't want to insert in that case. So in a family or between and among friends, putting in the pleases and thank yous actually is setting up a distance between you. There is a degree of formality, and even can be kind of offensive, rather than saying, hey, what's going on here? You know, you're my buddy, you're my friend. You don't need to say please and thank you. That's what's polite, is when you strip away that kind of formality of please and thank you.
I'm wondering if you got to the point where you were, in fact, dreaming in Chinese, which is the title of your book. Were you seeing characters? Was that the language in your sleep?
I dreamed a little in Chinese, but not a lot in Chinese. It was more like this odd dictionary dream where I was looking for a word. It was more like this frustrating experience with the tones where I was trying to say something and get it across, and someone not understanding me.
Pretty much the story of your time there.
The story of my life in China.
Deborah Fellows, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Melissa.
Deborah Fellows' book is Dreaming in Chinese, Mandarin Lessons in Life, Love, and Language. You can read an excerpt at npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
If eggs could talk, they might say it's not their fault. Eggs get contaminated because the hen that is laying them is infected. Eggs themselves, if they come from a healthy bird, are remarkably resistant to contamination, as Anna Weigren reports.
John Ingram's backyard is pretty typical for suburban Sacramento, except for the large chicken coop tucked in between the clothesline and the gleaming pool. Its 13 residents strut proudly and keep John up to date with their news.
It means they've laid an egg, they're cackling. Isn't it curious that they would announce to the world that they've laid an egg rather than keep it a secret?
John is my grandfather, and he's also a microbiologist. He's spent years exploring the world of tiny organisms, and so-called retirement hasn't changed that. He says there are very few places in the world that are naturally germ-free. But eggs from a healthy bird are one of them.
The reason they stay germ-free is because of their chemical defenses.
Bacteria may get through a crack in the shell or the membrane underneath. But then the egg white fights back.
Inside there's three proteins that are very effective antibacterial agents.
One is called lysozyme. It isn't just in egg whites. It's in tears, saliva, and the drippy stuff that comes out of your nose.
And lysozyme has the honor of being discovered by Sir Alexander Fleming, who also discovered penicillin.
Fleming happened to notice that when drips from his nose dropped onto certain bacteria, they died.
The lysozyme kills bacteria by breaking down their cell wall.
Lysozyme doesn't work on everything, but it can pop a lot of bacteria. And the egg white has two other ways to kill invaders. There's a protein that prevents bacteria from getting an essential vitamin, and another, called conalbumin, that deprives microbes of iron, which they need to grow. It's a pretty effective system, though John says there was an incident several years ago when a certain egg processor suddenly had all their eggs go bad.
No one could figure out why. And it turned out they were washing their eggs in iron pans.
Which meant there was just more iron than the conalbumin could mop up, leaving plenty for the microbes.
Hi, ladies. Hi, ladies. Uh-huh, yeah. We got two? Uh-huh. One for each of us if we want one for breakfast.
John reaches into the nest box and pulls them out. I know these are probably the most spoiled chickens ever, but looking at their living quarters, I'm pretty glad to know their eggs have ways to keep microbes out. And John says the eggs will stay microbe-free for several weeks, even at room temperature. But wait a minute. I thought we were told to keep eggs in the fridge and not to eat raw eggs, or things with raw eggs in them, because of salmonella. John says if the eggs come from healthy chickens, like his, there's no problem. But as the current recall shows,
chickens tend to be notoriously susceptible to infection with salmonella.
And if the chicken that's laying the egg is infected with salmonella, it's likely its eggs will be infected too. Which is why you're told to cook eggs, to be on the safe side, since most chickens don't get to live in the backyard.
So we're breaking an egg.
But I'm about to get a surprise.
Even a broken egg will last quite a while if it's not cooked. But a cooked egg won't last very long because you've inactivated the proteins.
So, no hard-boiling eggs unless you're planning on eating them right away. And if you've got eggs from super healthy chickens like my grandfather's, why not eat them right away? They taste wonderful.
Mmm, good. Mm-hmm. It's a good egg.
For NPR News, this is Anna Vigren.
If your email is driving you crazy, if you're getting too many in your inbox and you feel like it takes too long to sort through and clear it all out, welcome to the world. Market researchers say nearly 300 billion emails are sent each day, and the average person sends and receives 110 messages. To the rescue, perhaps, is Google. Today, the company is releasing a new program for its Gmail service that will supposedly set priorities for the inbox. NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
Not sure which email to read first? Wrong emails turn up in the spam box. The new Google system sorts through all of your emails, and it puts the important ones in a separate priority inbox.
The magic here is really that it's personalized.
Matthew Glotzbach is one of the engineers who figured out how to assess your behavior and the contents of your messages and sort out what's important.
Looking at the people that you're emailing with back and forth and looking at your actions, like which messages you've replied, which messages you've starred, you know, and which messages you've deleted to try to get a sense for what's important to you at what time.
Glotzbach claims that in Google's testing, people who use the new system saved about a week's worth of time over the course of a year. Inboxes are a big time suck, says Martha Egan, the author of Inbox Detox.
Any technology that can help people choose what's important and what isn't can be valuable if used in the right way.
Got that? She said, if used the right way. Gmail may be able to learn based on your past actions, but what if you think too many things are important?
When you're trying to manage your email and your inbox, managing yourself is more important than managing all of those emails.
Egan says some people even get so obsessed with using time management software that they waste even more time.
They become a slave to the technology and spend more time managing the technology than using it as an advantage to them.
The question is, how can you develop technology that gets around the human tendency to waste time? Dr. Michael Fried is working on an answer. He's a researcher at SRI, a nonprofit that does research for government and business. Fried wants your inbox to actually do tasks for you.
What you'd like to experience is have your email client say, hey, looks like this message requires that you go change the sales forecast for Acme upwards by 15K for the third quarter. How about if I just go change cell C23 and make that change for you?
Fried says we are getting closer to the day when that will be possible. But he does see Google's new tool as an advance that's a step up from just having a spam box. Still, for some, says Fried, the best answer may be an old-fashioned human assistant, who at least for now is likely to still have plenty of work to do. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Bloch.
And I'm Robert Siegel. There is news today that could influence a hard decision facing women at high risk of breast and ovarian cancer. A new study shows that women who discover they have a genetic mutation called BRCA can dramatically reduce their odds of developing breast cancer if they choose to have a double mastectomy. Also, if they have their ovaries removed, they can further reduce the risk of breast cancer and ovarian cancer. NPR's Patty Naiman tells us more about the study's finding.
Researchers from around the country tracked nearly 2,500 women with BRCA mutations who had surgery to try to prevent breast and ovarian cancer. Researcher Timothy Rabeck is an epidemiologist at the University of Pennsylvania.
We found that mastectomy provided a huge risk reduction in terms of subsequent breast cancer risk and death, and the risk reduction is probably in the range of 80 to 95%.
And for women who had ovaries removed, their risk of ovarian cancer decreased as much as 80%. Rabeck says these are all huge decreases, but cautions that cancer risk will never be brought down to zero.
Because the tissue is never completely removed. Breast tissue is found throughout the torso and can't be completely removed by surgical means. And for ovarian cancer, the ovary leaves behind cells in the peritoneum that could go on to become cancerous. So it's just not possible to remove all of the tissue that might be at risk.
Nonetheless, Rabeck says the study findings are extremely reassuring. No breast cancer diagnoses among women who had double mastectomies. Among the women who did not have surgery, 7% were later diagnosed with breast cancer. One of the women who had a double mastectomy is 61-year-old Toby, who lives in New Jersey. She doesn't want her last name used because she's worried about her health coverage, but she feels she did the right thing when she had first her ovaries and then both her breasts removed. Toby's mother died of ovarian cancer. About 5 years ago, Toby wanted to see if she carried the BRCA mutation. She did. And her doctors initially told her to just watch it very closely.
After my genetic testing, they would alternate a mammogram with an MRI every 6 months. And I thought I was getting very, very good surveillance. And I felt that that would probably be enough. And it would be, you know, I would be in a situation where they would be able to diagnose something very, very early and be able to cure me if I did develop breast cancer.
But another doctor thought otherwise. Breast cancer caused by BRCA mutations are particularly aggressive. Toby's lifetime risk of that type of cancer was as high as 90%. Toby had a double mastectomy and was one of the women tracked by researchers in the new study. So far, so good. In an editorial accompanying the study, which appears in the Journal of the American Medical Association, oncologist Virginia Coclamani says the findings are important because lives can be saved if women have genetic testing.
A lot of times I see these women having had a very preventable breast cancer, preventable because I can identify the fact that they had a higher risk of getting breast cancer had they been genetically tested a few years prior to me seeing them. They would have had the option of having a bilateral mastectomy. So we could have prevented these breast cancers, and we didn't.
For Toby, it's been about a year since her surgery. She's had reconstruction, and today she says she feels physically strong again, but really it's the emotional change that comforts her.
My mother left me when I was 26, and it was extremely painful and traumatic for my entire life, and I just didn't want to do that to my children. I had a chance to
control that. I had a chance to fight what my mother never had a chance for.
Oncologist Kaklamani says women with the BRCA mutation should be counseled about genetic testing and strongly consider it. After that, the decisions are their own, but the findings of this study, she says, should be extremely useful, helping them decide what to do. Patty Namond, NPR News.